Hello and welcome to Spy Hards Podcast, where your hosts go deep undercover into the world of spy movies to decipher which films make the knock list. But remember, this information is strictly for your ears only. I'm Agent Scott.
And I'm Cam the Provocateur. And Scott, go back to your duties, you miserable pervert.
That's literally, genuinely my outro line.
That is my new game, is to try to take away your outro lines with my intros.
I don't like this game already. Can we please stop playing?
Scott wants the game to end.
I really do. This spy game.
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Starting off on a high, folks. But before we get to this week's film, speaking of highs, we need to induct our latest Spy Hards Die Hard. And if you don't know what that is, I'll throw it to old Mr. Smith over there to explain.
Yes, if you'd like to become a Spy Hards Die Hard, leave a 5-star review for us on Apple Podcasts and tell the world what you appreciate about the Spy Hards podcast. We'll then read your review on the show and also give you a top secret Spy Hards Die Hards code name.
Absolutely, and this is one of my favorite ones we've received in a while. This comes from Apple Podcasts in the USA from a username, Arthurus Rex Kundam et Futurus. Now, I may have butchered that. What I found out is that actually means something. I think it's Latin, but I can't tell you for sure. But here is what it translates to. Here lies Arthur, king once and king in the future.
Ooh, okay. That's pretty good.
This person already has a spy nickname. I'm not sure we need to give it to them.
Yeah, I think it'll be better than the one I actually have, because this movie left me with very limited options.
I think we'll stick to that then. But here is the review. Masters of their spy craft? 5 stars. Spyhards have mastered the craft of interview, polite interrogation, and debriefing. I have learned so many heretofore hidden behind-the-scenes details from Spyhards interviews. The hosts Scott and Cam disarm their guests by demonstrating a genuine interest in their life stories. We are thus able to learn nuanced details about niche films and wider truths about the history of the entertainment industry at large. Part of the magic of the Spy Hards interview is a tested and true formula or procedure for the Q&A. Keep up the good work, Scott and Cam. I love your coverage of the Pink Panther films and everything Michael Caine. I look forward to more coverage of the Dalton Bond films, the tall, blonde man spy comedy films, and so many other deep cuts from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I also request more episodes on the films that might have been. Gentlemen, you are true professionals and are providing a valuable service to those who love his and her Majesty's Secret Service.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. And first off, I will say the Tall Blonde Man films are on our list to cover at some point in the future. As to the movies that could have been, I'm assuming they're referring to the Moonraker episode you did?
I think so. And maybe like, you know, you think of like Jeff Kleeman. There was a couple of bits and bobs in that interview there where it was like the spin-offs that could have been. And that really is an interesting facet of spy movies. I mean, one thing you tend to find is that a lot of that is to do with the Bond films, because they're such a prolific series in sort of spy movie canon, and they've been researched so much that we know these scripts exist. Whereas, you know, I don't know about other versions of Spy Game, for instance, which is actually a bad example.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Or alternate versions of Condor Man.
Oh, I'd love more versions of Condor Man. But I genuinely thank you for this review. Heartfelt, detailed, just like we try to be with the interviews, and I think you're getting our vibe on that one too. Arthurus, I'm not going to try and butcher the username once again. Maybe it's Arthur. I'll call you Arthur. Thank you for the review. Thank you for being a Spy Hards Die Hard and being a listener. There are plenty more 60s, 70s, and 80s deep cuts to come. Don't you worry. And we're currently considering what Bond we go back to next. It could be Dalton, it could be Roger Moore. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah, for sure. And so I guess that brings us to Arthur's code name. I think we have to go with Agent Earthsave.
See, I genuinely think they should stick with the Latin.
The Latin is probably better, but Earth Save is pretty good. Like that, you're not just like passing envelopes. You are saving the Earth.
From alleged aliens, may I add.
That's right. We are going spy-fi here. So, you know, there's kind of like a mythological element to Arthur's nickname there, you know, for the review. But we're taking it outside of the Earth. Mm. They may be saving the Earth, but they're doing it from space.
Which is the best place to be, according to Moonraker anyway.
Well, you know what? Bringing it full circle. You know, the reference to movies that weren't made. You know, he's talking about the alternate version of Moonraker. We're going to outer space. It's all tying together beautifully. Oh, I don't know.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Symmetry. Beautiful bow. I love it. It rhymes.
Earth save it is.
Earth save it is. Thank you, Arthuris, for being a Spyhards diehard. Make sure you all jump on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. But without further ado, let's get to the review. All right, Cam, put your fake beard on and grab your dodgy Aussie accent. Let's get to it. What are we talking about this week?
We are talking about 1965's The Spy with My Face, which is, of course, a expanded episode of the 8th installment of The Man from U.N.C.L.E.'s first season, previously known as The Double Affair.
Okay. I wondered if the episode was called The August Affair, because they keep referring to The August Affair in the film.
I know, it's so strange. August Affair is such a boring name, so I guess they were like, you know what, the double affair is more interesting because there's a double.
Allegedly so, anyway. Now, this is our second Man from U.N.C.L.E. film. We're going without a guest this time. This is our first time really talking about them solo, if you pardon the pun. Starting early, folks. Strap in. But if you haven't seen The Spy with My Face, here is your synopsis. And I'll note, we're running into the same problem we ran into last time. The letterbox where we usually go for our synopsis has a very, very brief one. So I've gone to IMDb, which has a tiny bit more information. And I think it's just a bit better written.
I'll say the letterboxed one for this film is at least accurate versus the one for To Trap a Spy, which was completely wrong.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. But here we go. Here's the IMDb synopsis. U.N.C.L.E. agents Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin are sent to the Swiss Alps to find a secret nuclear weapon design, but Thrush agents kidnap Solo and replace him with a lookalike double.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, cut to the double having the vast majority of the screen time in the episode.
Yeah, technically speaking.
Or film in this case.
Did you know just one of the films this reminded me of a lot was Thunderball?
There's definitely some Thunderbolt elements, yeah. And I mean, this would have been, I'm trying to think of like the shooting order, because they both come out in 65, but mm-hmm. they like crank these episodes out quick, right? And the episode aired in 64.
Well, this must have shot, well, this came out in 64. So, I mean, one of the things we're going to get into in this review is Cam has been watching the TV show contemporaneously with our reviews. So you've seen the episode of the television show this is based off.
Yeah.
Do you see all the guy in the head get up in the episode?
Yes, that stuff is, he's not there initially when you have that scene early on where it's Santa Berger and him and the other guy in a room talking. That scene is not there, but he is there in the restaurant and then also on the bed when they're doing the voice matching.
Okay, so you do get that sort of reveal then.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. There's the fact that like Napoleon Solo answers the door and sees himself and then gets basically incapacitated. We saw that. There's like a redheaded seductress villain. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Thunderball parallels. And I'm curious how much is just pure accident versus how much was them knowing that Thunderball is shooting and like looking at the source material. I have no idea. But I don't even think Fiona Volpe is a like, you know, Ian Fleming character. So I don't know.
Well, it's also important to note that Thunderball released in the UK, at least, in December of 1965.
Yeah.
So it was probably shot during the early portion of 1965 in the Bahamas. So yeah. This was probably shot first.
Probably, especially given a TV schedule and how fast they'd crank these episodes out. Yeah.
I'm not saying one led to the other.
No, I mean, I think it's probably coincidence, but it's a crazy coincidence.
Yeah, especially when you like look, the film before had Luciano Paluzzi in it as well.
Yeah, right?
Like all of these things are just converging onto this and Thunderball. I when I watched it the second time around, I started like picking out plot points that connected to Thunderball. And it is an interesting sort of web that he has woven. That's the correct word.
You have a character also getting trapped in like a steam room, yep, which is like the steam box in Thunderball.
Mm-hmm. It's all there. It's interesting. I'll talk about the film in a bit, but yeah, just those connection points are interesting, especially given this is, I mean, Goldfinger really kicked it off from Russia with Love a little bit too, but Thunderball was like the biggest Bond of all time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the poster said. And this film did some of Thunderball before Thunderball did it.
Yeah.
That's people like say things about us online about how we don't do like the big films every week. This is the reason why. You watch this and you go, this maybe led to Thunderball. That's crazy. You won't ever get this connection if you're just looking at things like The Spy Who Came In From the Cold every single week.
Yeah, and even we talked about The Chairman fairly recently, and it had like the whole character with the one eyeglass thing, like the one dark, you know, eyeglass. And it's like, that seemed just like that guy at the end of Casino Royale 2006. And it's like, Are they related? Maybe not. But those kind of ideas were floating around in the spy universe long before that, you know, Casino Royale got there.
And see, like with films now, they make like things like mood boards, and they look for reference points into past films and media to sort of color in what they would want to see in their film. I could believe that someone, you know, Googled spy film with eye patch and The Chairman popped up.
Yeah, it's not even like an eye patch, though. It's like someone with like glasses and one of the lenses is dark. It's very specific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's true. But let's get on to the Uncle Train, because I've been missing a bit of my Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin, which I'm also very happy to see is much more of a player in this film.
Yeah, no kidding. The first film to trap a spy, also known as the Vulcan Affair TV episode, is very light on Ilya.
Well, it was, you know, go back to that episode on sort of the genesis of these films and the TV show to learn more about that. But originally, this whole thing was pitched as a solo project for Robert Vaughn's Napoleon Solo. It was called Solo.
Mm-hmm.
So it evolved into The Man from U.N.C.L.E. But Cam, I want to throw it over to you. I mean, you've been following along with the TV show. I assume you hadn't seen this version of the film at any point in your life.
No, I had never seen the film, and I've had a very easy journey because in the time since we watched To Trap a Spy to now, I only had to watch like 7 episodes to get to the episode that this is expanding, whereas the next stretch, I think I have like 22 episodes or something like that to get through until we get to the third movie. So that's going to be more of a marathon than this has been. This has been an absolute joy, though, is working my way through these episodes and seeing kind of the evolution of the show.
Do you feel like it has changed over that period of time?
Yeah, I do. Ilya is obviously a part of that in that he becomes much more of a presence on the show. He's not in, so far, like every episode. He will always pop up, but there's a lot of them that are more Robert Vaughn solo vehicles. There's going to be a lot of solo kind of puns going on here, but you know what I mean. It's very clearly still very heavily on the shoulders of Robert Vaughn. But what I am noticing too is like working in slowly more of the kind of silly or campier elements that are all over, I think, this movie and somewhat in the episode as well, the episode, The Double Affair. It definitely is like playing up the womanizing way more than previously, where it was like Napoleon Solo is charming and he may have a romance in an episode, but he's not like full on just like dog.
Right.
Whereas that's what you're getting here. And so I'm curious because I'll be moving forward after today into the future of the show, you know, finishing off season one as we move towards our next movie. And I'm very curious whether we're going to continue down that road, if we are going to go back to more of kind of the cool, charming Napoleon I saw in the earlier episodes that I really enjoyed, or what?
Well, I mean, and one thing to sort of say, this isn't going to be a beat for beat of the film or a beat for beat of the differences between the film and the TV episode. But I'll probably throw it to Cam at some point later just to ask you, like, is there any standout things that were added in?
Well, I'll say this much. This is the only theatrical Man from U.N.C.L.E. film that is expanding a one-hour episode.
Interesting.
Even the solo pilot, which turned into To Trap a Spy, is over an hour. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, a little bit of a longer work they'd created there. And the other ones we're going to look at in the future are based on two-part episodes where there's a lot less new footage. This one, though, they took a 50-minute episode and just blew it up with like 40 minutes or something like that added.
Right. This will be interesting to chart that course then, because I have some notes about this whole one story being turned into an hour and a half.
Yeah. It's interesting because when I was watching The Double Affair, and I watched it the night before watching the movie,
mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there watching the episode going, really? This one? This is the one they went to for a movie? Okay, well, I'm curious to see how this is, because I'd watched other episodes. Like, there's one called The Shark Affair, mm-hmm. with Robert Culp as like kind of like a...
Which, of course, you loved.
Well, there's no sharks in it, though. Oh. But Robert Culp plays kind of like a, I don't know, like a paranoid, almost like pirate type who's creating almost like a Noah's Ark to survive nuclear apocalypse, because sure. It is the 60s Cold War. There's a lot of paranoia. It's not necessarily your standard like espionage episode, but it feels big.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that feels more like a story that would lend itself to being a theatrical film than this episode, which feels, I don't know, it is weird to create a film around an episode where your lead character's off screen most of the time.
Well, I mean, they've circumvented that by having the villain also the main actor.
True, but if you are going to this movie and you have not watched the TV show, does this movie mean anything to you?
Well, they introduce him beforehand. You get that sort of intro of him doing the mission. So you know who, you know, Napoleon Solo is. And then you get like a massive exposition dump from the bad guys. It's like,
yeah,
this is the men from Uncle. That one's Napoleon. That one's Ilya. They go in a building. This is how.
That scene where it's the bandage guy on the bed and they're having that exposition bomb, mm-hmm. That scene is in the original,
but
it's different content.
Okay.
It's different content. So on the screen, you're not seeing, because all that stuff you're seeing, those black and white shots, are taken from the intro that is on the first 7 episodes of the series.
Okay.
Where it's kind of like Napoleon and Ilya walking into work and giving you kind of a guided tour of Uncle.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a primer for anyone who's tuning into the show for the first time.
Sure.
And they're taking shots from that and working that in there. The dialogue's all different. When you watch the episode, it's more about them finding the right tone to match the voice of Napoleon for the imposter.
Okay, but I think what we're doing is skipping ahead a little bit.
Definitely.
Let's get back to Our Men from Uncle. How did we get the second film? Let's hop in the bed with Bobo. Let's talk about it.
Not in the episode, by the way.
Oh, that's a real shame. That should have been in there.
Yeah. So the original episode and the film were written by a writer named Clyde Ware, who was born in West Virginia. And this was very early in his career. He had done work on a couple TV shows, True Story and The Great Adventure. And then 4 years into his career, he writes this Man from U.N.C.L.E. episode that is also expanded, of course, into the film. At the time of when the film comes out, this was actually a follow-up for him from an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour that he wrote. He would continue writing for TV for quite a while. He wrote 17 episodes of Gunsmoke and had a fairly low-key directorial career of theatrical films. He wrote 3 very obscure Martin Sheen films and did a couple TV movies, nothing that has any sort of name value, but he was a consistently working writer in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Also very important in fleshing out this story was writer Joseph Calvelli, who was also an associate producer on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. at the time. He had worked on season 1 quite heavily, and he was a New Yorker who started out in TV in the 1950s on the Jackie Gleason show. He only wrote 1 episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. He's only credited with 1, and that's this episode that was turned into a movie. But he basically was brought in to polish the script for The Double Affair, and then was the one that handled kind of the transition from it becoming a movie. And so a lot of the new material was his.
So a question I have, because going through the genesis of the first film, The Trapper Spy,
yeah,
was that they wanted it shot in color and to turn it into a film for release in European markets. Was the idea when they were writing this episode to have it as a film? Or was it like, okay, this is the best of the first bunch we have. Let's turn this one into a film.
I think that's more the case. The details on this one are pretty obscure. Like they don't give the kind of the behind the scenes exhaustive stuff on it the way they do with the first one, because so much of the first film is tied to the launch of the show and all the Ian Fleming of it all.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, they're like, yeah, yeah, this is the second one.
But like, because one thing that the show did in the first season is it's all in black and white, whereas this mm-hmm. is in color.
Right.
So does that mean the entire first season was shot in color? but only broadcast in black and white?
I believe that's the case, yeah.
Okay. Because otherwise, like, I thought maybe they had shot this one specifically in color to use as a film, but that's not the case.
I don't think so.
Okay.
No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Joseph Calvelli, who was, as I said, associate producer on the show in the first season, wrote the episode and the new movie material. He actually popped up on the show. He was in the previous episode to The Double Affair, The Giacco Piano Affair, which is a very tough title to say out loud. He shows
rolls
up.
Rolls right off the tongue, that one.
He shows up as a writer in a party scene. Mm. And he did go on to write two episodes of The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. and played a police chief in his final episode on that show, The Little John Doe Affair.
So you're saying there's like a continuity where he became a washed-up writer and decided to join the police force?
More or less.
And then like shot through the ranks to chief in a matter of like weeks, basically.
Exactly, yes. And so he had a very long TV career. Like, he's just one of these veteran TV guys. But he also did some uncredited work on Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller from 1971, which is a all-time Western classic.
Okay, all right. So there's a pedigree behind it.
Yeah, and then it's directed by John Newland, who was Ohio-born and began his career as a song and dance man in the group The Vikings.
Didn't we all?
Yeah, they were a vaudevillian troupe, and their trademark was wearing gold capes.
Is that a trademark? Wait, are they just wearing the capes?
I'm going to guess, like...
The Viking horn,
Part of their shtick was like having like gold lame capes or something.
What's lame?
It's like that material. I don't know.
I'm not sure you know. I think you just mean lame.
We won't be changing our name to Fabricards anytime soon.
Apparently not. Lamehards, maybe.
Yeah. So, John Newland bounced between stage work and radio. He was a performer. He was not someone who was a born director.
He's a Viking.
And exactly. He's a Viking. He's forging new territory.
He's pillaging his way into Hollywood.
But after he like made kind of a failed bid to move into like movie stardom with a contract with Warner Brothers, it just didn't really go well. He wasn't getting good roles. He became primarily a TV director in the mid-50s, although he did do two theatrical films. In 1957, he had two films, actually. The romantic drama That Night and the juvenile probation cautionary drama The Violators. And I'm going to read you the tagline from The Violators. The poster's pretty amazing, but it says, "Teenagers on parole, too young to know better, too hard to care."
We're back to the Viking horn on the second part of that line there.
Well, you should look up the poster. It's rather saucy.
I'm too hard to care right now.
So this man, basically, his career, if you go through it, it's like a guided tour of television of the 50s, 60s, 70s. He worked on The Thin Man, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Defenders, The Double Affair, obviously. And he actually directed one episode of the original Star Trek show, Errand of Mercy, which introduced the Klingons.
Wow, okay. Is that the one with the computer where they have to sacrifice themselves when the war games say they do?
No, it's more of a arms trading episode with the Klingons getting themselves associated with a planet and kind of corrupting it.
Yeah. I think I'm with you. Okay.
Yeah, and he worked right until 1983. So this guy really was there from kind of the big boom of television in the 50s right into the 80s when it got really trashy.
a true Viking till the end.
Yeah, exactly. And so this film opened internationally in 1965. It was released as a double bill with To Trap a Spy in 66 in North America. But in the UK, it was actually advertised as a Mr. Solo adventure. Despite the fact that Man from U.N.C.L.E. did actually become a top-rated show over there, this movie was marketed as the latest Mr. Solo story.
That's not got quite a ring to it, to like check in with your uncles or something like that. The uncles, caution uncles at work. Like, I feel like that's got more of a ring to it than a Mr. Solo story.
Is it because it's like Bond, four letters, B-O-N-D on the big screen? You can be like Solo, S-O-L-O.
I guess, but it doesn't. Bond means something. It had like at least 10 years of a lineage by that point from the Fleming books, roundabout.
Yeah.
Whereas this is... unless they're big Goldfinger readers, I don't think they'll know much about Solo.
What about just Vaughn?
Well, that might sell tickets.
Yeah, yeah, in that era, sure.
Yeah, the latest Robert Vaughn film.
Yeah.
I guess.
Mm. Why not? I mean, he had Magnificent Seven under his belt, so he had some really notable classics.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the reason why he is meant to have been the star of this.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And so the top three for the year, and I'm going to talk about 1965, the UK release versus the North American release. Number one was The Sound of Music. Number two was Dr. Zhivago. And number three, Thunderball.
And he strikes like Thunderball. Okay. Mm. Yeah, big year for it. Big year for Bond. Big year for spy movies. 65, 66. That's the peak.
That is the year. That is like the Thunderball phenomenon. You are coming off of Goldfinger and Thunderball just explodes. So, the Spy with My Face may not be carved in granite as one of the massive movies of that year, but it was part of the party.
Well, the thing is, at this point, if you make a relatively competent spy movie and put it in theaters, people will go and see it.
Totally. Yeah.
That's it. It just have to have some sort of a trailer with a mention of spy or spycraft or... Move over Bond, the next secret agent's in town or something like that. And hey ho, everyone turns up.
Yeah. And so the final note on this is they obviously shot a lot of new footage, about 40 minutes for this story. A bunch of that footage wound up in the season one episode, The Four Steps Affair.
Okay.
And according to Wikipedia, also the season two episode, The Dippy Blonde Affair. But I'm not going to guarantee that one because Bill Koenig does not confirm this on his Man from U.N.C.L.E. Watch guide that he has online that I'll have a link to in the show notes. So I'm going to trust Bill and that The Four Steps Affair, 100% confirmed, The Dippy Blonde Affair. Well, we'll see.
We'll throw it out to you, Uncle fans, Uncle Hards out there. Maybe don't use that nickname for yourself. is the Dippy Blonde Affair featured in this film? Question mark.
Well, I don't think it's... I don't even know if it's character stuff. I'm very curious where they're going to use that opening Robert Vaughn leading an assault on a compound. Like, that is going in an episode.
My guess was that, or it's the driving from Griffith Observatory in L.A.,
which scene are you talking about?
Well, like the car chase from Griffith of Park and stuff down the hills of...
With the motorbike?
Yeah.
Oh, that's in the episode.
Oh, that's in the episode. Okay, fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, folks, you've come for the uncles, but you're staying for the burger. Let's get down to talking about it. The Spy with My Face. It's our second Man from U.N.C.L.E. film, loosely. I think I'll lead us off.
You should, yes. Mm. Because this is actually interesting because we're going to be coming at it from very different places. Someone who has not watched the original episode versus someone that has. And we'll probably have that dynamic as we go forward.
For sure. And also, this is the first time, I think, in Spy Hard's history where you're watching things twice.
Yeah, that's true.
That's always been my gimmick. So you're stealing. It's gimmick infringement.
I'm going to be like the master of U.N.C.L.E. content by the time we get to the final film.
You will be U.N.C.L.E. Cam.
I will never be a Bill Koenig master of U.N.C.L.E., but I'll be his, protege.
You're not the commander, but you're, the spy lieutenant.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But anyway, let's talk about it. I had some high hopes for this film going into it, because I had a lot of time for the first one. To Trap a Spy, it was so good, it made the knock list. It didn't get my vote, but you two voted for it, you and Bill Koenig. But I still really enjoyed my time with this. I thought, hey, maybe they would build off the success of the first one. And I have to say, I didn't vibe with this as much.
Mm-hmm.
I my top line was The Disappointing Affair.
Right.
I mean, breaking it down, I wrote, whilst there's still moments to enjoy, it lacks some of the predecessor's charm. It also feels like a massive downgrade in tension from the first one, almost to the point where I was checking my watch multiple times throughout. It really feels like it is something that has been stretched.
Yeah.
And it, of course, is. That's something that maybe we'll butt up against in the future. But all the things that really worked for me in the first one, which I think, looking at it now, I think the Vulcan affair, To Trap a Spy, Solo, is the pilot.
Yeah.
It's them throwing money at the screen to try and sell studios on this TV project. This is midway through a season. There's less money per episode. And I know they're shooting additional things for the film, but still, It feels very set-based. It feels really quite cheap at times. And there is just no driving force throughout the entire film. You're hanging out with the characters. It is very Thunderball in its own way. It's one of the things I noted down as a connection. It's very sort of laid back. You're just sort of hanging out with Robert Vaughn, David McCallum, and the cast of characters around them. Not to say there isn't moments I enjoyed. I think some of the performances were fun. Senta Berger is always great to see on screen. I love her in every spy movie I've seen her in so far.
She's a movie star. Like, she walks in and you're like, there's a movie star. Like, she just like kind of lights up the screen.
It's like putting Sophia Loren in here. Like, it's just, oh, yep, there it is. There's the money. Every penny.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And like, you compare her presence to, say, like, the guy that plays the primary villain, like the dude who gets shot at the end. You're like, I don't, anonymous man, like, I don't know who this guy is. And then she's there just like a 1,000-watt stare, you know?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. If we're talking about Thunderball, in scenes where you've got like Luciana Paluzzi and Adolfo Celli as Largo, Adolfo is doing a big performance and he's like being arch and villainous. Whereas the guy who captures Napoleon and does the face transfer, I couldn't even tell you who played him. Isn't his name Darius II?
I believe it is Darius II, yeah.
So Michael Evans, who plays Darius II. Makes you wonder what happened to Darius I.
Darius II hopes you don't find out.
Oh, don't ask those questions. I don't know. I wanted to love this. And the second time round, I had such a bad time with it because there wasn't even like an exploration of watching it for the first time. There wasn't even that joy of exploring and finding something new. There was almost nothing to take from it. So I just found myself comparing and contrasting to other spy projects around the same sort of time. To bring it home, it just didn't work for me as much as the first one did. I'll talk about things I liked. There were plenty, but there were more dislikes in this.
Well, one of the big differences is the original To Trap a Spy or Solo pilot is pretty character driven. Like, there is a plot. There is an espionage plot that our heroes need to stop, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, so much of it is about the female lead of that film/TV episode going through this journey, being brought out of her kind of domestic life into a world of spy craft and being very, you know, kind of almost like revitalized by that experience. Mm-hmm. And then also just getting to know Napoleon Solo. There's a lot there in terms of just character stuff, hanging out with the characters. Whereas, like, with this this movie and episode, it's not really hanging out with the characters, and they're injecting stuff throughout to give you a little more. Like, Ilya has far more to do in the film than he does in the episode.
Okay.
Everything to do with the romance with, you know, Napoleon Solo's girlfriend, girlfriend's friend that he has here, that's all added. There's, like, little bits throughout to really boost his role.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, it's actually, I think, to the detriment of the film, because one of the things that builds tension in a story is smart people basically having to compete against each other.
Mm-hmm.
Our heroes come across as incredibly dumb in this story. You have this double, and the only way apparently anyone can tell it's a double is because he's not horny all the time, like Napoleon Solo.
I mean, this guy is so bad of a kisser that the villains decide to just throw the plot out the window and just give up on their schemes because this guy can't kiss well.
Yeah, he's that sad a sack. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, okay. And there's like some fun to that of kind of the Robert Vaughn almost like kidding his on-screen persona that he's just like kind of a loser.
Sure.
So I there's fun there in terms of like some of the performance work and like there's some clever moments, but like, because you've injected all this extra stuff with Ilya and the other team members and whatever, it makes them look really dumb that they're constantly being fooled throughout. And no one has any sort of sense of getting wise to this, feeling like there's any tension about this weapon that could be stolen. It feels like a real, like a leisurely little stroll through the world of Uncle with the stakes are big, but also no one seems that invested in them.
Well, I mentioned it at the start when you talked about the Project Earth Save. Like, the whole concept is there is this superpowered weapon that like outscales nuclear power and nuclear weaponry that is been devised because we have found that there is perhaps likely intelligence in the cosmos coming our way. So we've built ourselves an Earth defense system and they've buried it underground. That's a pretty big thing, right? That's a pretty big plot device. And if they're going to steal that, Like, imagine the implications. It's you know, die another day and he's laser beam.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, it's that kind of level of stuff. There's never that impression that what they're getting is anywhere near devastating, and that they particularly care that it has been taken or is going to be taken.
No, I mean, we do get to see the weapon, mm-hmm. where you open the door, and if you stare at it without goggles, you'll just be in a rapture and wander in blindly. And I was like, okay, I mean, I guess the idea would be they would transport this and open up doors or something, and people would walk into it.
I mean, I compare that sensation to when you're drunk at about 3 a.m. and you walk past a McDonald's and the doors automatically open.
Filet-O-Fish.
Filet-O-Fish? What's wrong with you?
It's not me. I actually had a friend in journalism school who, whenever we would go out drinking, he would go and hit the McDonald's for Filet-O-Fish.
Oh, my God. I just threw up in my mouth a little bit. That's disgusting. That's not the last thing you need after, like, hours of drinking. Get a hamburger in you or something. Or, for the vegans out there, get a nice non-meat alternative.
Sure. Yeah. That was his thing. I'll always remember that.
Fair enough. But yeah, that sort of sensation I can definitely understand. But you talk about them looking like goofs. That scene is a perfect example because there's like five of them in the room. Robert Vaughn is being played by the doppelganger of them all. He's the villainous version of Napoleon Solo at this point. The switch has happened. And he pulls the goggles off one of the other guys and practically throws him in. And the other guys are about a meter away and just turn and go, huh.
My favorite part is when they go back to the hotel after.
Right.
And they're like, were you guys going to go mountain climbing? And they're like, not really feeling like it right now. It's like, okay, well, fair enough.
I'll one-up you again. It gets even worse earlier when they're on the plane.
Okay.
Right. And there is this whole like convoluted thing where the duplicate Napoleon Solo has to go to the bathroom to take the stuff out of the briefcase that he's chained to, but he has to be escorted to the bathroom because you can't leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
This is fine, but he switches the suitcases in full view of both agents that are standing in the open doorway. But because of how it's shot, you think it isn't the case, but you can clearly see them standing right there and no one's like watching him as he's in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Completely baffling. These guys are meant to be the best of the best.
I know.
Now, I know you've got like an Australian one and a couple of other places in the world, but they're meant to be uncles.
It does not do a lot for the PR campaign that uncle would be leading at this point in time.
No, people will not be running to them in droves for protection.
No, it's like when it's all said and done, Napoleon Solo looks awesome. Kind of. Mm. I mean, he breaks out of there and saves the day, right? Like, he does an awesome job. But, like, everyone else associated with Uncle just seems really dim.
Well, like, even Ilya Kuryakin is taken down by a receptionist with a baton and then tied to a sauna. And he would have just died in that sauna if it wasn't for his love interest who took him out.
Randomly.
Randomly.
Who just was walking by and was going to go into the sauna and was like, oh, I hear a noise in there. Maybe I should check.
Isn't it weird that, like, in the first two films, one of our uncles almost dies from steam?
That is actually odd. I also thought it was weird that you and I recently have now tackled two works of media featuring female characters named Taffy.
What was the other one?
Remo Williams, The Prophecy.
Oh, yeah, of course. The Remo Williams TV show. Check out the Patreon, folks, if you want to hear more about the Remo Williams TV pilot. It's a doozy.
Yeah, I thought that was crazy. I was not aware that Taffy was such a popular name in spy circles.
You actually kind of like misled me a little bit there because you said, oh, you and I recently. And I was just thinking, have we been to a sauna recently, Kat?
Not yet.
Was it my doppelganger that went with you?
But yeah, like the problem with this is like not only does the team look rather dim, but because this is a 50-minute story, and I actually think like the 50-minute version is pretty entertaining.
Okay.
Like, it's not one of my favorite Uncle episodes, but it's a little more focused.
Mm-hmm.
You have the setup of the double. Will the double make away with the weapon? No. Okay. That's your hour. You know, it works as a story. But because they've piled on so much extra material here, it is kind of like building up massive amounts of screen time around a story that doesn't feel that consequential.
Yeah.
And so it's not like at your core, you have this really fantastic, unforgettable spy story. It's kind of like kind of standard stuff of the era, but you've like thrown in all this filler to try to make it feel longer and I guess bigger.
And bigger.
Yeah. But I don't know that a lot of the additions make it feel that much bigger. Maybe the assault at the start of the episode, which had me writing the note, Napoleon Commando. But like, you know, outside of that, most of the stuff they are adding are smaller scenes or a lot of like sexy bits. Tons of that stuff is all added.
I heard that some of the scenes that were to do with them, with Napoleon Solo and Centerburger's character in bed and in the shower and stuff were cut.
Yeah, that stuff's all for the movie. Mm-hmm. All of the stuff with the love interest in her apartment with Bobo the Clown and then Napoleon making out with her on the bed, that's all added. Napoleon having the sex scene, I guess, with the masseuse is all added. So, yeah, it's like they're really doubling down on Napoleon Solo as almost like James Bondian womanizer, which, like, that wasn't one of the charming elements of, I felt like, a lot of the earlier stories. He might have a romantic interest where there is kind of that, you know, that smooth Robert Vaughn charm, but it's not like this guy who's just running in a thousand directions after any woman who walks by.
No, maybe they were just trying to ape on Bond a little bit with the film version, especially if it was designed more for European audiences at first, whereas they wouldn't be as up to speed on Uncle, whereas a film would be more of a catch-all.
Yeah, I mean, those elements are in the TV episode as well, just not as overt as the movie.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the stuff we did like, because I'm sure there are things to talk about. I'll lead us off with, I think the Uncle quirkiness is still there, which I quite enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Anything from, we mentioned Bobo the Clown.
Crazy. Absolutely insane scene that you have these two, you know, beautiful 20-something-year-old women sharing a apartment together, and they have an inflatable punching clown in their bedroom.
I mean, I just use you, usually.
Fair enough.
But also, like, you know, you have David McCallum's Ilya Kuryakin taking on two little robot toys that are firing very badly drawn missiles at him.
Yeah, that's basically the opening of the episode, actually.
Oh, that's in the episode?
Yeah, that's almost the opening.
Okay, right, okay. That explains why they're badly drawn, but, like, that's just weird.
Yeah, it is crazy. And they have, like, the animated rockets. Mm-hmm. That's fun stuff, right? There is the weird shot, though, where it's, like, almost through smoke, but there's, like, a line through the film.
It's like they've had two shots put on top of each other. There's a smoke shot and then him behind the fence, and they've overlaid two bits of film.
Yeah, it looks weird.
Yeah, it doesn't quite work, but I appreciate that it has its own version of reality and it's stuck to it. It isn't quite reality we live in. there are not micro robots chasing us around. I'm sure there are a few more at the moment so I could pull out of my head. But like stuff like that, the quirkiness of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. is something I appreciated in the first film and even in the Guy Ritchie version of the film too. It had its quirky moments. And so I'm glad that's still alive and kicking here.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely is what works as well. Like, I like the little robot attack. I'm a fan of 80s robots, and I'm a fan of 60s robots as well. Mm-hmm. Also, that was also something in Remo Williams' The Prophecy was robot attacks. So this
Patreon.com/spyhards. Look at the show notes below for a link. Find out more about The Prophecy.
Was Remo Williams The Prophecy watching this film or TV episode looking for inspiration?
Well, I didn't think it had any, so probably not.
True. But yeah, like, it has, there's something fun about, like, just the energy of the show. Mm-hmm. And the film here, like, it's not lost. I don't feel like this movie, by expanding it, has lost kind of the fun of the episode. And just like little bits, like one of the fun moments I thought was actually Napoleon Solo when he's first captured in a very, like, relaxed capturing situation. But they have him against the wall, he breaks through, he knocks down all these guys, and then he just gets knocked out by the masseuse.
Mm-hmm.
And she just does this very quiet, like, sorry.
Yeah.
And that, I thought, was so much fun. I was, like, making notes in that. And I'm sure, like, at the time they're shooting these episodes quick, they're not really putting that much thought into it. But, like, it's such a quirky little moment that it stuck with me.
And also, like, another line from the masseuse where she says something like, you have a very, very well-developed latissimus dorsi. And he's like, oh, thank you very much. Like, what? Sorry? Why are you talking about latissimus dorsi? Is it this, like, spy TV show, this junky spy TV show?
Yeah, and she was actually played by Donna Michelle, who was Playboy Playmate of the Year in 1964, and will also appear, I believe, in one of the other Man from U.N.C.L.E. movies we're going to watch.
Something to look forward to.
That's right, yeah. Like, in terms of, like, casting these smaller parts, I thought this actually did a pretty good job, and maybe that is, like, a like for me, is that this is, like, in terms of, like, a propulsive spy story, it doesn't work, But what I enjoy about it is more of just kind of the quirky or silly comedy of it all.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, Donna Michelle as the masseuse, there's some funny stuff there. I like when he, like, takes the hairpin out of her hair. But I actually thought that I feel like I should hate this. But the Sharon Farrell, you know, character, Sandy Wister, who is the...
She's the best thing in the film.
She is so much fun and actually injects, I think, a little bit of the tension to this story.
Yeah, because it's like a ticking bomb. She
yes.
Is, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you have, like, the setup of her always being stood up by Napoleon Solo and, like, this kind of mounting frustration. You don't get as much of a sense of her fixation on him in the episode where he has all the, like, you know, when he goes to the office and there's all the memos, like, from her calling? None of that stuff's in the episode. It's more like they go out on the date, he stands her up, that kind of kicks it all off.
Right.
Whereas here, they build up much more that he's constantly just ignoring her and what have you. But, like, I love the way that they set her up as kind of this, like, kooky, free-spirited woman, but is also someone who is, like, always at the heart of what is going on. Like, when she shows up on that plane and is serving the double, that might be my favorite scene in the entire episode. Because it's like watching someone who has no clue what's going on, which is the double, with someone who's just, like, getting mounting kind of, like, annoyance with him. And I'm like, that's, this episode and movie needs more of that. Because I think that's where, like, the really smart stuff happens. And when she shows up at, like, the resort, that's really fun too.
What I want to spell out is for the listeners who haven't watched the film, to give a little bit of context for this character. Imagine Sylvia Trench.
Yeah.
On again, off again, girlfriend of Bond. Okay. She happens to be an air stewardess in this scenario. She is on a flight and she sees James Bond sat at the back with a couple of his mates playing Baccarat or something, right? But he's undercover. He's pretending to be someone else. She goes over and goes, James, how are you? And you as the audience have to go, no, 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 don't say that. He's undercover. Don't do that. That's the sort of tension they're trying to build towards. And I think it's really good. I think the problem is the film doesn't lean into that at all.
No, like every time that Sandy Wister, that character, is on screen, she's like doing something that's kind of funny or energetic. Like, the scene with her and Bobo on the bed together is absolutely bizarre, but it's memorable.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a lot of this story feels like kind of a little generic when you're getting to, like, the, you know, the underground lair and all that sort of stuff. It's fun to see the set, but it's not exactly stuff that feels like really mind blowing, nor is a lot of the, you know, motorcycle action or anything like that. But when it comes to kind of the romantic hijinks that she is kind of sparking, that's where it kind of comes to life.
Yeah, because there's a genuine set of stakes to it. And I think it actually would have had more tension if it had been a sort of case where Napoleon was undercover, whereas this is, in this scenario, it's the duplicate Napoleon who has no idea who she is. But that could still blow his cover.
Yeah.
So that's why it still works as a way of driving some tension into the film. Another thing, I had her down as one of the things I wanted to call out that I really liked. But another thing I just liked about this film is you had more Ilya.
Yes.
I'm not saying it necessarily worked, and I do agree with you that it kind of drew some attention away. And one thing I likened it to, I mentioned Sophia Loren earlier, but Operation Crossbow, a 60s film we covered a couple of years ago, there is a whole 20-minute segment in the middle of that film with Sophia Loren interacting with one character from the film, and then she disappears. But she's not part of the film at any other points. The film stops to have her do her one scene, one very long scene in the bedroom, and then disappear again. And it feels like that film stops dead to do it. It's one thing we lamented about the film. This has a kind of a similar issue with Ilya, but it is good to see him as someone who didn't get a lot of him in the first film.
Yeah, and I think, like, the spa scene, it's silly, but it's memorable. Like, it gives his character an actual beat and something to do. Whereas, like, they also inject him into that whole thing. You know, the Australian... tail agent,
yeah,
who's basically following, that's all added as well. That character is not in the episode.
The Australian's not in the episode at all.
No, I don't think so. He's definitely not in any of the scenes where it's, like, introduced by Waverly. I can't remember if he's in, like, the background of a shot or something like that, but all of his material where they're actually focusing on what he's doing, that's all new. And, like, that stuff, they have more Ilya there because you have the double killing Kittredge with the cyanide cigarette, and then Ilya's there being like, oh, he's a diabetic, we'll stage it as that, yada yada yada. But it makes Ilya look stupid So it's like they're giving Ilya more to do, but at the same time, he's looking stupid by doing this stuff.
Yeah. And I will note that this uncle agent from Australia is named Kittredge. Mm-hmm. Before we had Kittredge in the Mission Impossible films. Again, is it a connection to other spy media?
I'm going to say no on that one. Because maybe if it came from an episode, but like the theatrical expanded version of an episode, I don't know. That's a stretch.
Well, maybe one day we'll find out. But it's just interesting to hear that name muttered in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. when we're so used to hearing it in Mission Impossible.
True. Yeah.
What about you? Another like?
I mean, Santa Burger as a presence, I think, is very strong. And there's an earlier episode in the season where you have another Thrush agent that Solo has kind of an on and off again kind of romantic sparring with.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a little bit of that here. I think the character's motivations get pretty lost over the course of the story. But like when she has scenes with Robert Vaughn, like when they're hanging out, you know, in her like luxurious apartment early in the story.
Yeah.
I think like they have chemistry and she seems so much more well-acquitted to working in the U.N.C.L.E. world than she did in the Matt Helm world, where it was, I believe, the third Matt Helm film, The Ambushers, which mm-hmm. I believe the actress said that was like a very unpleasant working experience, not because of you know, any shady dealings on the set, but more in the sense of just like not connecting to the tone or the material at all. And it feels like here she's much more comfortable and really works well.
Well, if my memory serves, in the Matt Helm film, she's playing more of like a super intelligent agent who like outwits Matt Helm a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Whereas this, she's more just like the honey trap in a lot of ways. She's just there to sort of lure Napoleon Solo in and use her feminine wiles, if you will, to get him on side, to stand in a very particular space, in a very particular way, in a very particular room, just so that one statue can breathe on him.
I love like the spy villain traps of the 1960s, where it's like if he had been standing just like two steps away, that would not have worked.
I imagine the years of planning that go into getting Napoleon Solo to stand on that mark on the floor.
No kidding. And what I love about Santa Burger too is she always seems really cool in this. Like, you watch the way she has scenes with Napoleon Solo and then Sharon Farrell's character, Sandy Wister.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, the Sandy character seems very almost, like, immature and naive. And the way that Santa Burger, like, is composed and holds herself, she comes across as, like, the coolest customer in the room. And that's saying something because Robert Vaughn typically does play that cool customer in the room character on, I'd say, other episodes of the show. This one, not quite as much.
Well, yeah, they meet, all three of them, in the lodge at one point, and it's like his girlfriend from home and his girlfriend on this mission meet, and Santa Burger's just like, hey, we should go for a walk together.
Yeah.
Although, it's never really lent into, but is that meant to be that they're going to kill her on the hike?
Yes. Well, they were going to it later on. I don't think they were going to initially. Initially, they were just going to kill Napoleon Solo, but then later they said they'd kill her too.
But was the hike meant to be to the observatory?
Or was that part of the mountain climbing trip?
Is that not the same thing?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Very, very, very confusing. We're getting lost in the mountains, Cam.
We are. We are rolling down that hill like the double at the end of the episode and film.
Last thing I'll mention for likes is Robert Vaughn.
Mm.
It's hard to deny his star power. The guy is a born, like, Bond analog. He looks great on screen. He's charming. He's witty. His double is not one I'd like to spend time with, apparently. Not very good kisser.
It's a real dud.
Really is. A real like 4 out of 10, that guy.
Yeah, no kidding. I kind of like that he's almost like trying to be more of a romantic type. Like, you have the scene of him and Santa Burger in the sauna, where you can tell he's like, okay, I gotta like step up to the reputation of this guy. And she's just like, meh.
Which one of us do you think is getting the OG Robert Vaughn reaction? Which one's getting the duplicate Robert Vaughn reaction from Santa Burger?
Oh my God. I think we're both
getting the duplicates, aren't we?
Yeah, we're both getting the double. Maybe less than the double.
I don't think we even get let into the sauna.
We are the Michael Evans Darius 2 character.
We're Darius 1.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't want to know what happened to Darius 1.
You do not.
We're more like Darius Zeros.
Oh, beautiful.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Look alive, agents. We're here with important intel on how you can support the Spyhards podcast. See, we don't have Electra King bankrolling us, which is why the Spyhards Patreon is so crucial. But fear not, we have bonuses galore.
That's a bingo. Over on the Patreon, you can listen to our ever-expanding Agents in the Field library, where we review major movies from your favorite spy actors, plus our latest show, OSS, in which we dive into the world of Cloak and Dagger television, from Ian Fleming biopics to Le Carre miniseries and more. Now, Cam, tell the listeners about this week's top secret broadcast.
We're flying to Jupiter's moon with Sean Connery to check out the 1981 space western Outland. Will this trip to the mining facility yield gold or not?
So strap on your Condor Man wings and soar into the future with us over at patreon.com/spyhards.
But before Big O zaps us with a red pulsating laser, let's get back to the spy jinx.
Okay, Cam, we've all got uncles that we don't like. Let's talk about the dislikes for the spy with my face. I've got a few. You've definitely got a few. I'll lead us off.
Yep.
Well, I've just got to talk about that sort of tension and pacing issue. We've spoken about it before, but this is practically asleep compared to the first one.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the character stuff, like you said. I just would have liked to have seen some more action.
Yeah, there's very little action. I mean, they've obviously added a bit at the start of the film, which a lot of it is shot in like fast motion, so that kind of robs it of the excitement.
Well, it speeds up and then slows down again. Like, I don't really understand what was going on there. It's like that rear projection stuff in Thunderbolt, funnily enough.
It's almost like early Zack Snyder speed ramping.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, no. Who would have thought Zack Snyder was taking taking notes from The Spy with My Face?
It needed like a slow droning pop cover over top of it to really complete the package.
Sure. And like someone scantily clad for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah. A lot of focus on the like physique. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you do get the money shot from Robert Vaughn in this film, though, to be fair. You get his top off.
What is with that moment where it's like Robert Vaughn walking up to a mirror shirtless and just like smiling at himself?
I'm not the best when it comes to self-love of how I look personally. I have a lot of like issues with my physique and things like that just from, you know, old, many years ago. I've never felt good about myself until I watched this film.
Where you're like, well, if Robert Vaughn's that cocky, I should be a hell of a lot more cocky.
I should just be whipping my top off at every given opportunity because I look about as good as Robert Vaughn does in this. And apparently he's a stud.
Every woman is falling over themselves for him in this story. Yeah.
To be fair, that was like the look at the time. Because you look at Connery in, mentioned Thunderball again, walking around Shrublands. He looks pretty like what people would call a dad bod now, which I'm not shaming anyone for having any type of physique whatsoever. But it's interesting that like the beauty standard has changed over the last 60 years.
Well, now everyone is on these like human growth hormones and everything to look absolutely ripped beyond all belief.
Yeah.
Like back in the day, that was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be like, wow, like that guy looks unlike anyone else in movies. And same with actually Stallone followed down that road as well.
Yeah.
But now it's like every male action star is made to look like that in a movie. And you're like, sure, I question the long-term health effects of this, but okay.
And I won't, you know, go too much into this, but I've always been a proponent of, if you're going to do that sort of stuff, just admit it and say that you are, so people don't have this idea that they can attain it naturally.
Yeah.
I spent many years working in gyms, and I've been around many people who are bodybuilders and, you know, do physique training, stuff like that. And I have no problem with people who actually take the stuff and just go, yeah, I just want to look like the movie stars, or I want to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger or whatever. Absolutely fine. But yeah, like I would much rather look like Robert Vaughn in this than Chris Hemsworth in Thor Love and Thunder.
Who even he was like, that was a miserable experience and I hated it and I'll never do it again.
I could understand, because at least Robert Vaughn got to eat food.
Yeah, like Robert Vaughn was living it up. He is, you know, smiling at himself in the mirror, and then I'm sure living the swinging 60s lifestyle outside of shooting this film. And again, he looks very like everyman.
Yeah, and he gets to step into a shower with Senta Berger I mean, wearing probably stuff on their top half and do the most awkward footsie inside of a shower you've ever seen in your life.
I just keep thinking of, and I kept thinking at the time too, of like Roger Moore in his Live and Let Die diaries talking about his knees bend workout. And you're like, okay, like that's clearly something they thought was a focal point of fitness at this point in time for like your male action heroes.
Uh-huh.
And all I could think about was Robert Vaughn doing his knees bend workout.
Is he doing it in the shower with Senta Burger though? That's the question.
Maybe they're both doing it. Like that was their like daily workout routine.
Hey, babe, do you want to bend knees? Oh, yeah, all right, let's do it.
But normally they're wearing like 60s workout attire.
Right. It's like David Niven in Casino Royale 67 on his little gym at the start.
Exactly, yes, yes.
Oh, the knees bend workout coming to your local gym. Watch out for it, folks. Cam will be demonstrating it for us all at the end of the episode.
My knees are old and creaky at this point. I can't.
They need bending.
Yeah, they do. I wish someone could bend them.
I'm so old.
Like sticks. Pathetic little sticks.
What about you? Something you disliked?
This feels like a TV episode. That's a problem.
Sure.
Because this is a motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like To Trap a Spy pulled it off a little better.
Mm-hmm.
It still had TV level, you know, film craft going on, but it felt a little bit of a bigger story.
Yeah.
And I feel like this feels too much like a TV episode to really sell as a motion picture. Especially like the first half hour of this film is all new material.
Right.
Like it is so much time of the villains basically telling the audience what they are going to do for like half an hour. It's like the From Russia with Love book, but like not good. You know, it's not effective. It feels like you're just going back to the pacing you talked about. You're just kind of like delaying the inevitable story because the elements of the story that are effective are diluted by all this new material and waiting so long to get to it and then throwing in little romances throughout to just kind of like really break up the propulsive elements of the story. Like to me, this is a problem because it's like, okay, if you're going to kind of like drag it out for 90 minutes, okay, I guess, it worked for To Trap a Spy, I guess. But like it should feel when you get to the end, at the very least, your time has been well respected and paid off, and that you should have something big happen at the end, some sort of big exciting set piece or something. The motorcycle stuff is fine. It totally works in a TV episode.
Mm-hmm.
The stunt double is very visible, very, very visible. But, you know, you get to see him throw a grenade in the back of a truck and then like a smoke bomb go off and you go, okay, sure. When I'm watching the TV episode, that's a fitting into a TV episode. When I'm watching a motion picture and then the kind of very like choreographed on the day fist fight between Robert Vaughn and his double, which I will, you know, to say something positive, they do a really good job of masking the double. I think that's actually really well done.
Yeah, that looks pretty good. It looks as good as a TV episode could look.
Exactly. Yeah, like they do as good a job as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what, 2 years after this, there was a Star Trek episode. You know, they waited until episode 8 of Man from U.N.C.L.E. before you got doubles. Star Trek did it in 4. That one is far shakier than this one. And I think like they do a decent job with kind of selling the double part of it. But in terms of like ending it on that fist fight by the side of the road, it feels very, very small. And maybe they should have, instead of shooting this big action opening, focused more on shooting an action finale or something.
Well, despite it being like an on-location shoot in Griffith Observatory and the roads around Griffith Park, you think of like the big like laboratory in To Trap a Spy, that felt bigger.
Yeah.
They used like a brewery or something for some of the shots running around that. It looked like it was a bigger thing. This seemed very small. You're right. It just seemed very small and inconsequential. And when you, yeah, you go, I mean, I just couldn't imagine watching this on a big screen.
You'd be scratching your head. And I mean, when you think also of that that big industrial, you know, building they had in the first one, when there was like the explosion and stuff, it felt real.
Yeah.
Whereas like you have the Griffith Observatory, which, by the way, the Swiss Alps, get the hell out of here. But when the Griffith Observatory like explodes at the end of this, it looks pretty cheap.
Yeah. It's almost irredeemably so. You could tell there was not a lot of money put into this, and I think that's a real shame.
the money, I guess, went into the added material, but yeah, it just, it feels too small. And it was actually really funny, after I finished watching it, I was going through and reading Letterboxd reviews from users, and so many people who watched this were not aware watching it that it was a Man from U.N.C.L.E. episode that had been expanded.
Right.
And they were just completely baffled as to what they were watching.
I totally get it. Like, if you went into this with no context whatsoever, especially in a double bill with To Trap a Spy, can you imagine those two back to back?
Yeah.
This is not the crescendo. This is the opening salvo, and then you would do To Trap a Spy first. Second, sorry.
Do you think, like, knowing the way they would often organize and air, say, TV episodes or movies or things like that, do you think they actually, in the double feature, aired Spy With My Face first?
I could totally buy it if they did. I mean, I think it would throw off kind of, there is a lot of explanations in the first one that, actually, to be fair, like, Waverly is different in the first one. So,
yeah,
it is all over the place. Like, you have Leo G. Carroll here, who is the mainstay throughout the whole show.
Yeah.
Which I'm glad that does get sort of ironed out.
Yeah, he gets more to do in the movie than the episode. But right. Yeah. It just goes back to that feeling like you're watching something small.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to see in theaters the Star Wars Clone Wars when they stitched together like three episodes and showed in theaters. And I remember just sitting through it and being like, I watched three episodes of a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how many people have that kind of feeling walking out of The Spy With My Face.
I totally would understand if that's how they felt, because it is exactly the scenario. Much as there is 40 extra minutes in here, there is stuff to enjoy within those 40 minutes, but none of it like adds scale. You think with the 40 minutes, you would do stuff to make it feel like a bigger, you know, globe-trotting story. There's a lot of like telling you they're in these places, but don't look like the places that they're actually in.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do... Stuff costs money, I understand that, and this is meant to be kind of a cheap way of getting a bit of extra money. I totally understand, but I just wanted something to make it feel grander.
Yeah, and even like a moment, going right down to a moment that kind of sums up how like kind of small it feels, is when you have the death of Darius II and he sets the self-destruct for the Griffith Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
And Napoleon just walks over and turns the timer to like half an hour. And yeah. I'm like, wait, what? You can do that?
The days of analog. You can just be like, I'm just going to reset this self-destruct. That's fine.
Yeah, it's just like, there's so little tension, and when they actually build a moment of tension, Napoleon comes along and is like, nope, not on my watch.
To be fair, this film is all about dials. You've got that, you've got the sauna dial as well.
That's true. We needed a dial on the Earth Save weapon.
The spile with my face?
No, definitely not.
Sorry, I'm done. I have one dislike that I feel might be a harsh critique. It really is a matter of perspective, but it did irk me.
Okay.
And that is not necessarily the character of Namana, but how Namana is treated.
Right.
Namana is a U.N.C.L.E. Agent. I can't remember what country he's coming from.
I think they say Africa, don't they?
Okay, let's go with that.
Yeah.
He's a person of color. And in this, you first introduced him, and what the Australian agent, Kittredge, goes, oh, I knew your brother. And Namana goes, yeah, he died.
Yeah.
And everyone just no-sells it. Like, no one goes, oh, I'm sorry to hear that, or
so
whatever.
Awkward.
Everyone's just looking at each other like, oh, gee, this guy brought the party down. But then, Namana is the one who is sacrificed by the evil Solo by taking his mask off, and then he gets pulled into, you know, McDonald's at 3 a.m. And then no one sells that either. The guy literally dies in front of them, and all four people that are standing there, including the receptionist lady, are like, well, he's gone.
I like how the receptionist lady held the door for him to go right on in. She didn't even try to close the door.
Don't stop him. He's the only black character in this episode. Let him go.
He's already gone. Don't worry about
it.
Like, what
fine.
Happens if she closes the door? Is he just, like, brain dead for the rest of his life? I don't know.
Some people might prefer that to, I don't know, eternal damnation in a space laser.
Is it a laser? Is it a radioactive room? I don't know.
I don't know. The film doesn't know.
I know. It's kind of, like, very sci-fi. It's just, like, you know, like, fantasy room.
What's your premise, actually? Let's dig into your premise for a second. You think it's, like, a room. that will destroy you.
I thought it was like radiation. It was like a radiation room. Yeah.
In your scenario, aliens land and they say, take me to your leader. And then Napoleon Solo goes, hey, step in here. Here he is. And they go, ooh, and walk into McDonald's at 3 a.m. And that's how we defeat the aliens.
I thought of it kind of like Sirens on the Rocks.
Sure.
Where it's like, because you have to wear the goggles. Otherwise, you are so entranced by what you're seeing and this like rapture they talk about that your brain just switches off and you just are drawn into it like a zombie. So I was like, I guess they're like using this somehow to draw enemies towards it. And then they'll just basically be, I don't know, vaporized or something.
Like, it's just the logistics of getting an invading army to step up and, like, one by one walk and look into this door.
I guess you'd have to have multiple doors.
The elaborate steps they took to get to this bunker, which is clearly a set taken from Star Trek.
Yeah.
Or given to Star Trek, because it looks just like any of the underground sequences in any of the episodes of Star Trek.
Yeah.
I guess it was probably just something they had on the lot. But yeah, pretty elaborate plan. I'm just going to hope it's a space... That's like the power generator for a space laser.
Well, if you're using a laser, though, like, doesn't that kind of take away what it does? Like, you're firing it as a weapon versus, like, people being drawn to it and like dooming themselves.
But
like,
how do you leverage that? How are Thrush trying to steal this? Well, if it's not a laser or some sort of weapon, are they just stealing this bunker door thing?
Yeah, how do they transport it?
Are they burning through the rock? Is this a very elaborate, you know, heist? Is this like Fast and Furious 10 where they steal the safe and drive it down the street? Well, that's 5, but still.
Yeah, great scene. Is there like a physical thing? Like, have they generated this energy within this room? Is the room the weapon?
I don't know. I honestly don't think the film knows. And I think we could probably get lost in trying to hypothesize what it is. But either way, it totally mistreats the Namana character, which I know he's not a main character or even particularly a well-developed side character. But it's still like odd that the one black person in the film gets offed and no one cares.
Yeah, because also keep in mind the Kittredge character who's killed with the cyanide cigarette is not in the episode. So it really is just like one fatality in the episode.
Yeah. Weird choice.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Like, there's a lot of curiosities in terms of the decision making here. I don't understand why when Napoleon is kidnapped, they make it such a pleasant experience. I didn't get that either. Like, don't you want to have the tension of him needing to escape and wanting to escape?
Well, like, they were like, oh, we want your body to be supple and relaxed when we throw it down the hill.
And they're giving him like the meal and then peeping on him.
Yeah, I mean, if I ever do get captured, I want to be made supple and healed when I'm eventually killed by my captor.
Totally. And actually him putting the glass in his food was actually new as well. That's not in the episode.
Oh, okay. Well, fair play to Robert Vaughn for eating a light bulb.
The man was committed to his art.
Yes, he was. Well, I think before we get to a knock list, let's go to any final notes we've got. I've got a couple of questions and bits and bobs. What have you got, Cam?
I had a couple things. I did like the moment where after Napoleon has broken free, he goes up to that guy with the motorbike and breaks him over his knee. I was like, wow, that's a very aggressive action move for Napoleon Solo there.
Oh, yeah, he does, doesn't he? Sort of breaks him over the knee. Yeah, that was a really odd choice for these guys that were just sort of standing there. And I have to question, because these guys weren't working at the observatory. They were just like an army camp nearby. Were they working for Thrush, or were they just a random bunch of soldiers? Because then Napoleon Solo blew up some random US soldiers with a grenade.
I'm going to say that they worked for Thrush. They were like Thrush's little army there.
I just could have done with like a sign on the tent saying Thrush or something. Sure. I know it's not a very secret organization if you put the name on it.
Yeah.
But, you know, they look like army guys, and then Napoleon blew them up. Weird choice.
Yeah, and then also just the other thing I just wanted to mention was the Centerburger Serena character. I feel like if you're going to have this character who's so ambiguous about her motives throughout the story, you need to establish her better, because when she makes that decision at the end to shoot the double, it doesn't really make any sense. It's like, okay, I get that she had some romantic sparks with Napoleon at the start of this film, but given the journey we've been on, I kind of don't buy the ending with her.
I wish they kind of gone more like the Wei Lin way of that and had her just leave, because the whole idea is she's a free agent. She doesn't work for Thrush. she's just a pay for play kind of person.
Yeah.
So once like she shot the guy, because it's the end of the mission for her, she's like, well, I delivered you. I got my money. See you later. And drives off, takes his motorcycle and drives off. Like, that's cooler.
Yeah, I go back to the whole character aspect. And we talked about how, like, To Trap a Spy had a lot of really great character exploration. Mm. And that's not really the case here. It's very, very plot focused. And so I feel like if you're going to have kind of a complex loyalties kind of thing going, like she has, you need to spend more time with that character.
That's fair. I'm going to throw in, firstly, I tip my hat to this film for having Batman 66 style whip transitions.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
I don't know if that was in the episode particularly, but it stood out in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice touch. I also have two questions for you.
Okay.
The first question, what's worst, the fake beard or the fake Australian accent?
Probably the beard. I think that is more distracting to me.
I think he has a mustache. I think that's his mustache, but the rest of it is definitely fake.
Yeah. Why are so many of these like uncle agents so generic looking?
It was the 60s. It was a style at the time.
Yeah, fair enough.
Okay, last question for you. The whole premise of this is a little bit of like a body swap thing in a sense where you get a guy pretending to be an evil guy masquerading as Napoleon Solo. And the film is called The Spy With My Face. So I'm curious, Cam, what spy's face would you like to have?
Condor Man. That's easy.
You want Michael Crawford's face?
Yes. I think Michael Crawford and I, you know, because if I do that, then I get to wear the outfit. And I really just want an excuse to wear the Condor Man outfit.
So it comes with the outfit in your mind?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So So in my pick, I also get to keep the outfit I'm having along with it, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a very good choice. Very good. Very good stipulation there. I'm going to pick A View to a Kill Roger Moore without the mole.
Any particular outfit? Are you thinking like maybe the snowboard gear?
Yes. Yes, okay. At the start. Snowboard gear at the start, without the mole, and some minor touch-ups. But I really want Roger Moore's face and his ability to raise an eyebrow.
And scored to a cover of California Girls by the Beach Boys, yeah.
That's my entrance theme. That'll be the new, like, if we do this and you're Condor Man and I'm Roger Moore, which both very 80s spy superheroes there, I think I'll use the Beach Boys as our intro music.
Yeah, good call. And actually, speaking of music, that was actually another dislike for me, was they didn't play the Jerry Goldsmith theme for Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah, it's true.
We had Morton Stevens' music, but not quite as exciting as some of the better U.N.C.L.E. music.
I noted on my second time round that nothing really jumped out in terms of the music. There was no like sweeping scores, and you know, Jerry always delivers.
Yeah, and the opening music over that assault sequence is pretty weak.
Yeah. Okay, knock list time. The first U.N.C.L.E. film hit the ground running. It's already on the knock list. Number two, here we go. Cam, is The Spy With My Face making the knock list?
No, this one doesn't make the list in my eyes. It just, as we've said, lacks the tension and kind of the excitement of the better stories, and plus some of the character stuff that makes the show and the film world so far, judging from To Trap a Spy, more rewarding. So, I hope that this is maybe the lowest tier, but who knows what we're going to have coming up. But I would like to see the next U.N.C.L.E. movies improve on this one.
Well, yeah, we've seen it from the top and now the bottom.
Yeah.
In a sense, like good and bad versions of the films. It's given us kind of a calibration. It'd be interesting to see what the next one does. And I couldn't agree more. It's a no from me too. There are bits of merit in here. Centerburger is great. Also tip my hat to Sharon Farrell as Sandy Wister, the air stewardess. Great to see Ilya Koyukin have a bigger sort of screen time in this one. But it was just missing some of the elements of the first one. The scale, the tension, a bit of the charm as well. So yeah, The Spy With My Face, two no's, and as such, it is not making the knock list. The dossier on the film is complete and filed as classified. There you go. Two U.N.C.L.E.s down.
I wonder if they learned a lesson from this one, because the future ones are two-parters with very minimal new material. And so I'm very curious if that was either A, just because they wanted to save money, as opposed to having new footage on a 50-minute episode, or if they felt like maybe this one fell a little short storytelling-wise. Who knows?
Well, especially when they like put them together a lot of the time, the first two films. It's probably hard to tell in terms of box office receipts what was more popular than the other.
Yeah.
But they probably know from watching the two which was more successful.
if they cared, they may not have cared how good it was.
How cynical were they in the 60s? Well, probably quite cynical.
Yeah. Well, money was to be made at this point in time, yeah.
If Mad Men is to be believed.
Yeah, totally. Mm.
Right, well, the question goes to you, Cam. What on earth are we talking about next week?
Well, the 60s love continues because we are going to wrap up an era, a James Bond era. We are going to look back on the 007 Sean Connery adventures and break it all down with our typical roundtable format that we did for Pierce Brosnan and Bourne in the past. We're going to look at the best, the worst, the craziest, and all that sort of stuff. It's going to be a big celebration of Sean Connery Bond.
Yes, we have heard your emails, even though they were written. But they were that powerful that we heard them nonetheless. We know you wanted another round table, and it was about time we celebrated the work of Sean Connery and James Bond. He gave us 7 films as 007, and we're going to celebrate in style. We've got some fantastic guests joining us at our round table that I'll save as a surprise until next week. You won't want to miss it, folks. It'll be a bumper episode, feature length, I imagine, too, and we might just have a spy master interview in our back pocket for you as well.
Can only imagine.
I won't give you a hint as to who, but let's just say it pairs well with another one we've done in the past.
Right.
I'll leave that tease with you. So your mission, folks, should you choose to accept it, is to join us next week as we raise a glass to Sean Connery and his James Bond era as we sit around the round table and celebrate 7 films of Sean Connery's 007. If you like what you heard this week on the show, please consider joining us over on our Patreon, patreon.com/spyhards. You can help support the show, many different levels and tons of bonus content. And even if you don't go listen to the content, you can just support the show with a couple of spare dollars you have laying around the house. If you don't already, make sure you follow us discreetly, as always, on social media at SpyHards. That's SpyHards on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But until next week, folks, us miserable perverts are off to McDonald's for a filet-o-fish.